that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And back from his travels, Daniel Freeb.
Hi, chaps.
You're both back from your travels, actually. Lionel, you've been away at Paris-Nice. Daniel's been stateside. We've got a packed episode, as we say every week. We've always got packed episodes. We're going to be talking about the Cycling Independent Reform Commission, the CIRC report, which was published last week. We're still chewing over the bones of that. We'll talk about that in part one. Part two, we'll be talking about Paris-Nice. And we have an interview with Ami de Podcast, Christian Prudhomme, the director of the Tour de France. And in part three, we'll look ahead to Milan-San Remo. But Lionel, over to you first for the weekly roundup.
The World Tour resumed with its first event since the Tour Down Under in January. In France, Richie Porte won Paris-Nice after clinching the Col d'Huez time trial. Meanwhile, over in Italy, Peter Sagan won his first race for Saxo Tinkoff when he took stage 6 of Tirreno Adriatico. In fact, that was his first win since the Slovakian Road Championships back in June. Before that, Nairo Quintana won the big mountain stage in the snow at Terminillo, and that set him up for overall victory. Fabian Cancellara won the final time trial. Meanwhile, the Tour of Britain unveiled its 2015 route. The race will start in Anglesey, North Wales on September the 6th and visit Cumbria, Scotland and Northumberland before working its way south. The final stage will be held in London on Sunday, September the 13th.
From the cobbles of Belgium to the tops of the Alps, you're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So welcome back, both of you, the three of us together again for the first time in, it feels like a while. Daniel, did you have an enjoyable, interesting, fruitful trip to the States?
Very much so. Very much so. Didn't manage to relocate US marketing guy. Lionel insists that he's dead. The late lamented US marketing guy, but accomplished pretty much everything else that I set out to.
I thought you were meeting Bob Stapleton.
We'll talk about Bob later, perhaps.
How did you squander a two-hole lead and lose 3-1 to Lance Armstrong in the golf?
It's supposed to be off limits. We weren't supposed to speak about this. Listen, he plays 250 days a year. I play about 3 days a year. It was his home course. I had a lot on my mind. You know, there was a lot to talk about.
A lot on my mind.
It kind of scrambled
my...
You
know, I think he's got quite a lot on his mind.
No, it sort of scrambled my swing thoughts for the day. I had a game plan, and when I got out there on the course... You know, there was the Independent Reform Commission report. There was other stuff that I was there in Texas to talk to Armstrong about. And, you know, my golf game, I have to admit, suffered.
Did Lance have anything to say about the CIRC report? I know that he spoke to them. He was part of the process. So what was his reaction to the CIRC report?
Without going into too much detail, because this was not the main... Well, it was not the reason at all for my day with Armstrong on the golf course. But... I think he was slightly disappointed. I mean, he was glad to have contributed. He released a statement when the report came out to say that he was glad to have contributed to at least an effort to clean up the sport or restore some order to the sport. I think the way he put it to me was that when the CIRC was first announced, he hoped, he imagined that it might take the form of a conference or some kind of symposium where a good number of cycling stakeholders would get together over maybe a couple of days and hammer out everything that was hammered out in the report and, you know, leave after a couple of days with sort of clarity about how the sport was going to move forward and no real need to revisit the past. I mean, some people will say, of course, he wanted that to be the case because, you know, he wants his ban reduced, he wants to move on, he doesn't want anyone to talk about his misdemeanors. On a more general level, he feels completely exasperated at the reception that every sort of public utterance, every effort he makes, receives at the moment. You know, he felt slightly burned by the reaction to the BBC interview that he did recently with Dan Roan. He feels he's damned if he does tell the truth damned if he doesn't. That is the position he probably deserves to be in, but I think he finds it very frustrating, so much so that, you know, he said he didn't really want to do any more interviews unless they were on specific subjects. I was there for something quite different, as I said, but he doesn't really want to go over all of that old ground, certainly for the foreseeable future.
You spoke to Dave Brailsford, Lionel, at Pyrenees and got a very instant reaction. It was just literally hours after the report was published. Have you had a chance yourself to go over the report properly, and what's your reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, it was an ongoing thing, really. I mean, I stayed up overnight and went through in as much detail as time allowed. Just on that Dave Brailsford interview, you know, it was a kind of an instant reaction kind of piece, and I think the idea of that was to try and get his reaction not just to what he'd read in bits of the report, but also the immediate fallout from that report. And of course, on day one, the fallout from that report was the headline that 90% of the current peloton was doping. And I think, you know, that was the sort of strongest line that came out.
Yeah, as one rider, one unnamed rider claimed.
An anonymous rider said to the report. So I think it's only really over the coming days after that that, you know, the dust settles a bit and people's reactions, everything sort of moves on, and different aspects of the report have come to the fore over the coming days. But I think from Paris-Nice as a whole, the sense was, certainly among riders, I didn't speak to anybody who had read it. Anyone I asked, have you read the report? You know, they hadn't. They were concentrating on a bike race and weren't going to stay up and read it. And I think the main takeaway from it is, I think, as you said, Richard, that if you were going to write a book about not just one generation of doping in cycling, but, you know, overlapping generations that stretches back, you know, not just 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but to the dawn of the sport, really, you would put a lot more into your background research. I think you'd want to talk to many, many more people. And just having this kind of open door approach, come and talk to us if you feel you have something to say, I'm not necessarily sure that was the most effective way to go about putting together this research.
I think I should preface my criticisms by saying that I think it's better that the report was done than not done. I think there's some useful information in there about current doping methods, about some of the possible loopholes with regards to the biological passport and so on. I think some of that is very interesting. And some of the context to, you know, the UCI and how that organisation changed in the 90s is fascinating to read it. However, I think the great weakness of the report is the vagueness of it, the lack of detail, the claims reportedly made by unnamed riders without knowing who said what and why they said it, what their knowledge is. It's incredibly difficult to know how much significance to attach to these claims. The document sort of stands in stark contrast to the USADA reasoned decision, which was forensic in its detail. Now, ironically, or perhaps not, USADA come in for quite a lot of criticism in the CERC report for the way that they have gone about things, that some of the stuff that they've put into the public domain. The CERC felt that was inappropriate, that in fact wasn't in accordance with the WADA code, that USADA had flouted some elements, some aspects of the WADA code. They're also critical of USADA for the punishment they gave to Lance Armstrong, for the severity of the punishment they gave to Lance Armstrong. So there's a sort of subtext there. I don't know if there's a jealousy that the reasoned decision was so detailed and the CERC report is so lacking in detail.
Yeah, I think I also have a problem with the idea of offering anonymity for people to offer an opinion rather than information and facts. I mean, generally, can offer somebody anonymity in journalism, for example, if somebody's giving you some really significant information, facts, but not just to sort of state an opinion that they then don't follow up with any kind of evidence, really. And I think that's the source of most frustration amongst certainly people on Paris-Nice that I spoke to. Just to follow up again on one of the sort of the fallout, I guess, from the Dave Brailsford interview that we did last week, or that I did last week, one of the questions I didn't ask in that interview about the use of cortisone out of competition, for example, went back to Dave Brailsford a couple of days later and asked him what Sky's policy is on that, and he said that the policy is to not use cortisone out of competition at all. So, you know, this isn't a one-off thing. The CERC report is going to be relevant over the next months, if not years, and I think it's an ongoing thing. And I agree with you, Richard, it's a step in the right direction. It's not a perfect piece of work, but my experience of covering doping and cycling and the anti-doping effort is that so far there hasn't been anything that's been a perfect effort.
I think we'd be wrong to dismiss it completely out of hand, and I think it is. It should serve as a warning to all of us, because, you know, if we think about the biggest doping epidemic ever to sort of grip professional cycling, it was in the 1990s, and we think about the warning signs that there were before. It really all blew apart with Festina in 1998, and there was the Sandro Donati, an Italian scientist, wrote a huge report in 1994, I think it was, which really gave us all the information we should have needed about the EPO epidemic that had gripped the peloton. That wasn't heeded. Even Michele Ferrari himself in 1994 made the famous comments about EPO and orange juice. That wasn't heeded. Uwe Ampler, the East German rider, talked about systematic doping at Telekom. That wasn't heeded. And, you know, we're sort of haunted by the idea that we could all have been duped again, that, you know, we've been speaking for the last few years about cycling having cleaned up its act. And Rich mentioned earlier, I met Bob Stapleton in California last week. Bob Stapleton, of course, the owner of the famous High Road team, which had to bow out of the sport in 2011 because they didn't have a sponsor. And he talked about the difficulty of selling the team to prospective sponsors and how they were obsessed with doping and the danger that that posed to their sponsorship. When you bear that in mind, and I think we sometimes forget, you know, what a huge issue it is to the outside world, when you bear that in mind, you realise what an interest there is for the professional cycling world, for the riders, for the teams, to peddle this image that everything is okay again, that the sport has really cleaned itself up. And, you know, riders' salaries, riders' livelihoods depend on projecting that image. So when you bear that in mind, we should always be on our guard. We should always be aware that, you know, we could be duped. And the CERC report, I think, is useful in opening our eyes, reopening our eyes to that possibility again. On the other hand, the final thing I'd say is that it will also now create a culture of suspicion that in itself can breed the kind of problems that, you know, we've seen in the past, because we've heard people like Armstrong say in the past that cycling's a world where no one knows what the other guy's doing, and they kind of imagine what everyone else is doing, and it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, reading that report, even a clean rider could get the impression that, you know, he's 1 in 100 and that he's being duped and that he needs to get with the program. So I think that is the big danger of it.
One of the shortcomings is perhaps the absence of clean riders who've spoken to the CERC. And, you know, David Miller came in for some criticism for not having spoken to the CERC, but very few riders did speak to them. Chris Froome spoke to them, 6-hour interview. He's not allowed to really talk about what went on, but Dave Brailsford's suggestion to you, Lionel, that they should have gone to a race and interviewed riders there wasn't perhaps practical if that was the length of time they were spending interrogating riders. We know now that Alberto Contador, who requested anonymity and then revealed that he had actually gone to speak to them, did speak to them too. But looking at the named riders, there's a real imbalance there in terms of most of them, the vast majority of them, are former dopers. And the CERC report itself says that a lot of them spoke to them because they were looking for some kind of leniency in terms of their punishment, some perhaps shortening of their ban. So thinking about it from a rider's point of view, the CERC was going on about its business for the last 13 months. You know, if you're a rider preparing for races, racing up to 100 days a year, training, carving out a day to go and spend with them is quite, it sounds ridiculous, but a rider who is clean and doesn't feel that they actually know an awful lot about doping and perhaps hasn't been involved in doping will probably not feel that they've got an awful lot to offer.
Bear in mind also to travel at your own expense. You know, I know that might sound fairly flippant, but
none of us went and spoke to them, did we? I mean, you know, and I read it and I thought, you know, there were journalists that spoke to them. And I thought, should we have done? What was the protocol? I wasn't invited to, but some of us would have...
What would you have told them?
In terms of concrete facts, I'm not sure what I could have told them. Nothing. I could have told them rumours that we hear all the time, but a lot of these rumours turn out not to be true.
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, in the course of sort of writing a lot about Pat McQuaid and Lance Armstrong and all of the kind of conflicts of interest that did appear to exist during that era, I mean, one of the stories that I followed very closely was this purchase of the Sysmex machine, which basically a blood testing machine that the UCI had bought, allegedly, you know, with money paid for by Armstrong. That didn't really feature a lot of coverage. I mean, I had the same thought, and I wondered, you know, some other higher profile journalists that didn't go and talk to the CERC either but are expressing strong opinions about it now. It's a strange one, because it wasn't like everybody got an email saying come and volunteer what you know. And I think from Sky's approach, for example, they pooled information or resources at a sort of management level, and Rob Tansey went and spoke on the behalf of Team Sky. Jonathan Vaughters went and spoke for Cannondale Garmin, but as far as I know, there weren't many of their riders that went and spoke to Cirque. So perhaps when you do a body of research like this, setting the parameters at the outset and making it very clear what the aim of the thing is, and I think that's another thing that Dave Brailsford said. If he'd known how it was going to be published and presented, he said he probably would have gone himself in person to go and talk to them, but he felt he was a bit in the dark about how it was being conducted. He didn't choose to go on his own, you know.
And perhaps also those that compiled the Cirque report perhaps should have acknowledged that this chronic lack of engagement and lack of organisation that there's been going back years among the professional cycling constituents, the riders, the teams, you know, no properly organised union. You know, we've seen even this week the usual fiasco at Tirreno Adriatico when there's bad weather, some guys want to stop, some guys don't. Complaints that a rule needs to be brought in about, you know, adverse weather conditions, etc., etc. So for those reasons, it's not really a surprise that more riders didn't come forward.
Probably a good time to just mention that we're working on our own independent cycling commission, the PERC, the Podcast Independent Cycling Reform Commission.
Yeah, the PERC. We're going to stop this discussion because there's so much we could talk about, and we feel that we should probably do it over the course of 50 minutes or up to an hour, with lots of interviews from riders, directors, perhaps even people who didn't speak to the Cirque. So our PERC could trump the Cirque. We'll do that as a Friends special. Remember, you can sign up as a friend of the podcast for just £5, thecyclingpodcast.com. Our next Friends special will actually be a focus on the classics that are coming up, Tour Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. That will be available next week. Following shortly after that will come the PERC, and it'll be a special episode devoted entirely to the issue, I suppose, of doping in sport. What is the current state of play, as I say, with interviews with riders and directors?
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So let's turn our attention to some racing. Paris-Nice finished at the weekend with a victory for Richie Porte. Had to sort of claw it back from a disastrous day on Saturday in the mountains and the rain. Tony Gallopin won a really terrific victory. Took off with 30 kilometres to go and held them off. Maybe suffered for it the next day in the time trial at the Col d'Ez. But Richie Porte was the overall winner. You were there, Lionel. Was that a good week's racing?
It was a good end of the week's racing. Yeah, the first few days didn't really live up to what we hoped. Very much the race away from the sun this year rather than to the sun. It was very sunny in Maurepas at the start of the week. Then the weather got progressively worse, really, and it was quite bleak on the Côte d'Azur on Saturday and Sunday. The crosswinds that they anticipated would liven up Monday and Tuesday stages basically didn't blow, so the peloton was quite leisurely, really, and it wasn't great racing, but that's the way it goes. I mean, you know, can't guarantee what the weather's going to be like. They fortunately had reasonable enough weather for the Croix de Chauberet, which was a cracking stage, aggressive, and Team Sky took it on there. Richie Porte and Geraint Thomas executed a plan that they had, which was that for Thomas to accelerate at the point that he did and then for Porte to try and latch on and then go over the top. And it was really, Thomas was strong enough to stay with Porte. That wasn't part of the plan necessarily, but it did give them a very strong position going into the weekend. And then, I mean, Saturday stage was just one of those ones you couldn't take your eyes off because it wasn't that long, but the climbs were one after another. You know, the Col de Vence was a pretty tough start for it. We went at and actually stood at the top of the Col de Vence, and there were more riders in the break than there were in the peloton in one way or another. There was a big group off the front and then other groups trying to get across, and then Bradley Wiggins led what was left of the peloton over, and they were all going hard, breathing hard. It looked brutal, and I thought by the end of this stage there's not going to be many guys left because they had several second and first category climbs to go over. And of course it all lit up at the end. Mikko Kwiatkowski tried to shed Richie Porte and Geraint Thomas, knowing that he would be vulnerable in the final time trial on the Col d'Ez. And then that led to, it was one of those days where everything just seemed to happen one thing after the next. And Tony Gallopin took off, and I mean, few people really talked about Galopin and the strength of that ride, but that was seriously impressive. Sustain that for that length of time, what, 45 minutes, 50 minutes of really hard riding. And behind him, Sky were in all sorts of trouble. There were lots of talk about whether their tyres are pumped up too hard, because Richie Porte went down not once but twice, apparently. But we saw one on the TV coverage, his back wheel just slipped from under him. And then Geraint Thomas went down a little bit later, damaged his brake lever, couldn't change gear properly, couldn't brake on the last descent, which was treacherous, wet roads. And one thing that you kind of perhaps don't take into account is just how slippery those roads get down on the Côte d'Azur. And it's the same the ones in Milan-San Remo, isn't it? They're almost like ice once they're wet. The surface of them is so slick and so smooth, so pleasant to ride on when it's dry, but they do become pretty treacherous when it's wet. But it was a really great day's racing, and exactly, you know, what Paris-Nice has been like in the past, really, in the 80s and 90s, when aggression has netted results. It didn't quite net the final result for Galopin, because he wasn't able to turn in the sort of time trial he needed to turn in. But then, was that really expected? I don't think it was. He'd, you know, in the past, admittedly, he'd not been in contention to win, but he'd been 1:56 down on Porte on the Col d'Ez in 2013, so it wasn't a surprise. And I think it probably would have been a pretty big surprise if he had held on against Richie Porte in the time trial.
I wondered, though, if we were seeing a sort of coming of age of Tony Galopin, who obviously had a terrific Tour de France last year, won a stage, wore the yellow jersey for a day, similar actually to the Tour, where there was that big effort to win the stage and then he really collapsed the following day. He's obviously a decent climber, but he's quite big, and you wonder if he could ever be a sort of three-week stages rider. Probably not, but he's a very good rider. In fact, Lotto Soudal, I think, not one of the sort of glamour teams, not one of the big budget teams, but Tim Wellens, Thomas de Gendt now, and obviously Tony Galopin, they contributed an awful lot to Paris-Nice. I was interested in Kwiatkowski as well, because, again, it reminded me of the Tour of Britain, where he's obviously a terrific talent, but he really has bad days as well. And we saw that on Saturday, that he was wasted. He couldn't hold wheels on climbs, putting in huge effort, but it's quite good to see that, quite human.
But more to the point, he lost the race by trying to win it. He tried to get rid of Porte and Thomas, and it didn't work. But that's what you want to see. You know, you don't want to see him just kind of sit on the wheels and then maybe hope for a place on the podium in the time trial. I thought, you know, that was what made the day's racing. And, you know, Sky, they were aggressive themselves as well, and they get a lot of criticism for the way they ride stage races, very controlled. They pick their moments, as they did on the Croix de Chauberet, and, you know, they got themselves into the right position. But they tried to do something. When Kwiatkowski was on the back foot, they tried to turn the screw. It didn't work for them, and then they ended up paying for it on the descents and a couple of crashes. So you saw multiple teams try something in order to try and win the race, and that's not something we always see. So I particularly enjoyed that.
You mentioned Kwiatkowski and Galopin. I think they're two riders that both face the same challenge. And Kwiatkowski to a lesser extent, because he's young and he will develop, but they're both riders that don't really have a well-defined speciality. They're pretty good at everything, and for that reason I thought Galopin, having won a couple of big races the last couple of years, would struggle this year, because he really is a marked man now, and his previous big wins have not necessarily been a la pedal. They haven't been victories that have relied on strength alone. He's tended to pick the right moment and benefit from a little bit of sort of hesitation in the main peloton. Paris-Nice, as you say, the stage win on the penultimate day, in that light, was probably a coming of age, because he was certainly a marked man, yet he managed to pull it off. I don't think he's a Grand Tour rider. He's not a time trialist. He could do well in the Ardennes Classics, but I think this is, you know, races like San Sebastian that he's won before, individual stages of stage races, I think that's where his speciality is going to lie.
Should we hear from Christian Prudhomme, the director of the Tour de France? You spoke to him, Lionel.
I did, yeah. I caught up with him in Saint-Étienne on, I think, Friday morning. He was a little bit late because apparently he'd been on a secret mission checking out some roads around Saint-Étienne, possibly for future Tour de France stages. I don't know. We couldn't tease that out of him, but I asked him how he thought the week had panned out, the risks of choosing stages where you're relying on weather perhaps to enliven the racing. And then we moved on to talk about the Circ report briefly, and also the recent acquisition of a technological firm by ASO. I wanted to know how Monsieur Prudhomme sees the evolution of coverage of bike racing on television, whether in 5-10 years time it will look very different to what we're used to now. And then we wrapped up by talking about the Tour of Yorkshire.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
It's Thursday morning, the sun is shining. We haven't quite reached the Riviera yet, but the sun is already here on Paris-Nice. I'm with Christian Prudhomme, the boss of the Tour de France and also of Paris-Nice. Christian, can you sum up your feelings about Paris-Nice so far this week? The wind didn't blow the first two road stages, but yesterday the Croix de Chauvray gave us a good show.
Yes, the finish of the stage was very nice, yes. When there is a wind, it's much exciting, but there's no wind. There is a sun, it's a race to the sun. We have the sun at the beginning of the week. I'm afraid we won't have the sun in Nice this year, but we don't know who will be the winner, and that's very important. We have three riders in 3 seconds. Every year in Paris-Nice, you have the winner for only a few seconds. 7 times out of 10 times, it was less than 15 seconds at the end of the week in Nice. So I think we will have a very exciting race to the end to know the winner of the stage, even if Richie Porte and Geraint Thomas, Sky riders, are very strong for sure. But we have, as yellow jersey, the world champion, so that's nice for everybody.
Thomas told me that François Lemarchand, who is the race director, was very confident that at Croix de Chauvray would not be a problem with the snow, even though it's at 1,200 metres. Yes. It's still a risk, though, no?
You know, there is always a risk in Paris with the snow. The first time I was a race director in 2005, thanks to Jean-Marie Leblanc, we had to change one finish line and 3 start lines in a week from the day to the day after. So it was very difficult. In March, you never know. You can have 20 degrees. We are in Saint-Étienne, Courfeyrac. That's the history of cycling, the history of Paris, history of the Tour. A few years ago, it was 20 degrees, but a few years ago, too, it was -2 degrees and there was snow everywhere. So you don't know at the time. We have to deal with the geography of France in March.
Now, the Paris-Nice race runs at the same time as Tirreno-Adriatico. There is some overlap. From your point of view as the director of the Tour de France and the head of ASO's races, how is the competition between you and RECS for the best peloton?
There is a good competition. I have no problem with that. The only point is it would be better to have 1 week with Paris-Nice and another week with Tirreno, not in terms of riders, not in terms of champions, but in terms of media. It's better if you have all the place for one race and after for another race. That's the only reason, but it's what I say is only good sense, and I hope good sense will win. It would be better to have Paris 1 week and the week after Tirreno, of course.
And you think that's something that will happen at some point. Have you been monitoring, watching the development of the Velon organisation of teams, and how does that work with ASO?
I can't answer on that because I'm not in the discussions with Velon. I just want to say that in terms of live coverage, the more onboard cameras live we'll have, the better it will be for cycling, for everybody. So, but I'm not in the discussions with Velon. My answer is just the answer of a former journalist and a fan of cycling.
So in, say, 10 years' time, how different do you think the Tour de France will look on television? Do you think the sport will embrace technology increasingly?
The last 10 or 15 years, there was progress on showcasing the landscape, stunning landscape, outstanding backdrop, but no progress at all in terms of sport. I don't think it will be very different on the first screen, but the second screen. And I have a daughter who is 16 years old. She's always with 3 screens while watching TV. The first screen, our TV set, and an iPhone and an iPad and 2 other things in her hands. All the young people are like that now, so we need to have on the second screen, on the third screen, all the data that the people want to have. For the people who are fan of cycling, you must have in a few years all the data for the heart rate, for example, but also with the hotels or the campings, I don't know, depending on the people who are watching. So that's very important, yes.
Because the race itself is a showcase for not just the Tour de France, but every race is a showcase for the towns and the geography that the race goes through. So to make the experience more interactive for the viewer. Could you see the viewer would be able to choose to watch a camera from the breakaway and a camera from the peloton and a camera from the back of the peloton and become almost their own television director?
What I think, as a former journalist from TV, is that people from technology are very, very clever. More clever than we think. So they can discover many, many things. So we have to push them and they will find. But yes, that's very important. When I was a boy, when I watched soccer on TV, it was impossible to hear anything. Now you can hear everything.
My second last question. The Cycling Independent Reform Commission published its report into cycling this week. I don't know if you've had time to read any of the report or just see the coverage.
No, not all the
I've read through.
Pages.
It's a big report. It's a bit unfair to put you on the spot if you haven't read all of it, but what is your reaction perhaps to the way the media has covered it and the way that that portrays cycling?
The only thing is there is this report thanks to the UCI from today. What the media said is, cycling, not good. But the report exists thanks to the people from the UCI from today. And I don't know many international federations that say, do that, you are independent and you can ask anybody, everybody, who you want, questions on the cycling from the past and from today. So that's a good thing. But there is no news, no special news for people who know cycling. We are on the good way. It's not a perfect world. We know it's not a perfect world. Nobody can say in the world of cycling it's a perfect world, but you don't have a perfect world in all the sports. You don't have a perfect world in life. It's not a perfect world in our world. So we have to continue with the International Federation, with the riders, with the teams, with the organizers in that way. That's the good way. That's not perfect, but what we are doing is the good way.
Lastly then, I'm wearing the flat cap of Yorkshire. It's not long until the Le Tour de Yorkshire, the first event. Are you looking forward to going back? And I have to ask, are you hoping to see more bunting?
Yes, I have to learn a few new words, and my English teacher, Gary Verity, will be in Nice in 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, so I will ask him. But it's what the Grand Départ in Yorkshire is and will stay unforgettable. It was really the grandest Grand Départ ever, and it's thanks to the Grand Départ in Yorkshire we are a few steps higher now. And I just want to say to Gary and to the people from Yorkshire, merci. When I see the images from last July, wow, it's just unbelievable.
So that was Christian Prudhomme there. One thing that I found particularly interesting was that he believes that Tirreno Adriatico and Paris-Nice will not overlap with one another for very much longer. I suspect that talks are already underway. And from what he said there, it sounds like they would run the races one week, one the next week. This still wouldn't solve the problem of the riders splitting between the two events, but it would mean that we could focus on one and then switch our attention to the other without affecting the run-up to Milan-San Remo too much.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
In last week's podcast, Bradley Wiggins exclusively revealed that he would be riding the Tour de Yorkshire for his new team, Team Wiggins. This caused a bit of controversy since he was given special dispensation by the UCI Road Commission to leave Team Sky and join a new team mid-season to prepare for the team pursuit at the Rio Olympics in 2016. We met up this week with UCI President Brian Cookson to ask for his reaction to the news that Wiggins will be appearing in his new colours on the roads of Yorkshire.
You know, I think it's fair to say that I'm disappointed with the way that this has worked out. What happened is that a request came in from British Cycling, supported by Bradley's current team and by the team that he was going to, asking for dispensation for him to leave Team Sky because he was going to focus on the team pursuit and preparing for Beijing. So what I said was, I don't have any particular problem with it if that's what the National Federation, that's what the two teams have agreed on. But, you know, this is a matter for the Road Commission. So I refer that to the Road Commission and, you know, that was it. That was the last I heard of the issue. And, you know, I'm not trying to dodge responsibility for it. But, you know, then the law of unintended consequences comes around and we discover that Bradley's planning now to ride the Tour of Yorkshire. And I just think that just throw up a number of issues, not least the one you've mentioned. I don't know whether Team Sky are riding the Tour of Yorkshire and Team Wiggins. That, I think, is an uncomfortable scenario. So I'm a bit unhappy with the way that this has played out. But the reality is that it's not a parallel situation to the Armstrong situation, but I can see why people would say that it was. He has been given that dispensation now by the Road Commission and thus by the UCI, and I guess if he's eligible and his team is selected to ride the Tour of Yorkshire, then he'll be there. He'll have to be going up hills better than he was in Paris-Nice, though, won't he? sorry, Bradley.
Brian, we talked about independence of various components of the UCI, and you just said that this is ultimately the Road Commission's decision. This will, and it already has, created parallels with the previous leadership and McQuaid and, you know, the Armstrong case in Australia. Is this not exactly the kind of case where you could or should put your foot down and say, no, rules have to be observed?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it is making me uncomfortable about that, and there's no denying that. But, you see, on the other hand, if I'd intervened in this and said, no, this cannot happen, you know, we must stick by the rules, you'd be asking me, why are you sticking by these crazy rules? Can't you use some discretion and have some interpretation? Isn't it for the good of the sport to allow Bradley Wiggins to ride this event and so on and so forth? So, you know, we've always got to get a balance between using the rules in the right way, applying them consistently, but occasionally making an exception. And I think it's probably unfortunate that this exception is being used in a way that I don't think we'd intended it to be used. I think we'd intended, our understanding was that Wiggins would be competing on purely on a domestic scene thereafter, preparing for the track with perhaps an occasional foray into a stage race here and there. But on the other hand, you know, the team Sky didn't select him for the Tour de France in Yorkshire, so it will be a big boost for the event in Yorkshire and in Great Britain, and people do want to see Bradley Wiggins racing on the road. So from the point of view of the overall development of the sport, it's a good thing. But, you know, it's if I was to look at this situation again and go back in a time machine, I think we would probably think about it in a different sort of way. I'm not saying we'd have a different decision, but, you know, maybe we'd put some extra requirements into that.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So with thanks to our sponsor, one of our sponsors, along with Van Dessel Cycles, is British Eurosport. And coming up on British Eurosport in the next week, we've got Milan-San Remo on Sunday, and then the Tour of Catalonia starts next week. Always a good race. Feels like we're moving into the spring properly. But Milan-San Remo, let's talk about that a little bit. Daniel.
Well, we know that the course has reverted to what we'd call the classic route, the route that was used between 1982 and 2006. So we have the Turchino, which is the first, the big climb, but it's quite an easy climb as the riders come down onto the Riviera. Then we've got No Limagne, which was introduced in the middle of the last decade, and it tended to break the race up. It did eliminate a few sprinters. It certainly made the race a lot harder, but that will not be included in the route this year. Then we got the three Capi, Berta, Mela, and Cervo, and then the Cipressa and the Poggio, and then the finish on Via Roma, which last featured in 2006. The winner was Pippo Pozzato, friend of the podcast. And can Pippo challenge this year? I think he's very much an outsider. I think the favourites that I would say there are, well, two outstanding favourites for my money, or well, three outstanding favourites: Alexander Kristoff, Mark Cavendish, and Peter Sagan. Two of them, Kristoff and Cavendish, former winners. If any of those three riders are to prevail, I imagine that we'll see some kind of sprint finish, which looks like the most likely scenario on that course, which is an easier course than we have seen in recent years, in theory. A lot depends on the weather, of course. You know, if it's a gnarly day, bad weather, we'll see a more selective race. If there's a tailwind, we'll see a more selective race, one that will favour the kind of attacking riders, the Philippe Gilberts, maybe the Tony Gallopins a bit more. Other outsiders for a sprint, not really an outsider, John Degenkolb, but he's been fairly quiet the last few weeks since his outstanding win in Oman on an uphill finish. The Frenchmen, Coquart and Demar, had mixed fortunes this year. Buhani has had a terrible start to the season for Cofidis. So I think they're the main favourites, the main runners and riders.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Daniel Fausto on Twitter, I don't think it's Fausto Coppi, but somebody called Fausto asked whether Jalabert in 1995, Laurent Jalabert, that is the last rider to go from Paris-Nice rather than Tirreno Adriatico and win Milan-San Remo. Very much not the case, is it?
No, that was the trend for a long time. Tirreno produced far more Sanremo winners than Paris-Nice. In recent years, it's flipped slightly. We've had Christophe, last year Alexander Christophe, who rode Paris-Nice. Matt Goss, if I'm not mistaken, in 2011, rode Paris-Nice. Gerald Sielek, I'm not entirely sure. But certainly the most recent is Christophe last year.
We've had terrible weather at Paris-Nice on Saturday, but dreadful weather at Tirreno Adriatico on Monday. And I wondered if, I mean, it was exceptionally bad weather. Riders were clearly very, very cold, and some of them may perhaps struggle to get over that. Some of them might fall ill in the days before Milan-San Remo.
Yeah, I think it's a problem for their health. It could also be a problem for their form because, you know, yesterday we saw a big group come in quite a long way down, ride at a very leisurely pace. This has been a problem in Tirreno over the last few years, that there have been some very, very long, difficult stages, at least on paper, accompanied by some very, very bad weather, and a sort of executive decision has been made on those days to ride pretty slowly. And some riders have subsequently complained that at San Remo they haven't felt particularly good because previous week at Tirreno wasn't hard enough on certain days.
One person you didn't mention in looking ahead was Fabian Cancellara, finished, obviously a former winner, but he's finished in the top three of every Monument Classic that he's finished. Of the last 12 that he's finished in the top three. Didn't explain that very well, but I think you get the drift. It's an incredible record, but it's got to come to an end at some point. And I wonder, Cancellara's 34 now, whether we are seeing him start decline ever so gradually. I did enjoy a moment in Tirreno where he was having a bike change or a wheel change, and he sat down on the road and did some bit of Pilates or yoga, and I did enjoy that.
You mentioned Cancellara, and obviously a former winner of Milan-San Remo in 2007. He actually won the first San Remo on what at the time was the new finish line, on the seafront in San Remo. It had moved from Via Roma, and the finish line, the run into Via Roma, will be a lot more difficult for Cancellara if he wants to pull off the same kind of move. I think he went with about 2 kilometres to go then in 2007 when he won. The run into Via Roma is straighter, it's slightly shorter, so I think it's unlikely we'll see a rider escape if a reasonable sized group is together at the bottom of the Poggio descent.
This podcast comes out on Thursday, of course, as ever, and if you're listening to it on Thursday, Fabian Cancellara actually turned 34 yesterday, Wednesday. So happy birthday.
Not yet a friend of the podcast, but who knows, for his 34th birthday.
I haven't seen his fiver come in, have you? F. Cancellara, Switzerland.
No, I haven't. But we could tease a little bit into our next friend special.
I did see a Spartacus. That might be him.
It could be, yeah. Did it come in Swiss francs or pounds? Not sure.
Well, it's paid directly into my HSBC account in Switzerland, so I'll check that later. Yeah, we should mention that in our next Friends special, which is a focus on the cobbled classics, Flanders and Roubaix, we will be doing a bit of a retrospective on the careers of Cancellara and Tom Bonin, who unfortunately will miss this year's cobbled classics, having crashed at Paris-Nice. Looking at those two, there's a sort of changing of the guard perhaps happening this spring with young guys like Sagan, perhaps on the verge of winning one of these races finally. And Sepp van Marck, I think, as well, as one to watch. He rode extremely well at Het Nieuwsblad, was unlucky there. And he rode very well at Strade Bianche as well, which I don't think is a race that really suits him as well as the cobbled classics. But he's clearly in very good form. We've got a little interview with him for that Friends special.
Also, I think along with Greg van Avermaet, very much a potential assailant on the Poggio, Sepp van Marck. I could certainly see him trying something on the Poggio. Cancellara too. But what do we think is going to happen? Come on. Off the fence, chaps.
But this is kind of what we love about Milan-San Remo. And some people don't like it. Ian Forfar on Twitter yesterday said that it was a very boring race. It's just the steady build-up, this anticipation. You know, the rhythm of Milan-San Remo is so kind of well-known now that you know it's going to ignite and explode at the end, and that makes it very exciting. It's got this very long gradual build-up. But what we also love about it, I think, is the fact that it's one of the few races on the calendar, and this was summed up for me a few years ago when Simon Gerrans won, and he was in a group with Cancellara, Nibali, Gerrans, three completely different riders with completely different strengths in the same final selection. And there are very few races that on paper suits so many different riders. You know, you could have it can be won by a sprinter, it can be won by a ruler, it can be run by a puncher. You know, it's such an open race from that point of view, and I think that's what makes it so exciting.
Yeah, and I think this sort of cinematography of it is great as well. It goes straight down the coast, you've always got the sea in shot, you've got the little hills, and from a the perspective of watching the bike race, the cameramen do a great job, particularly with the aerial shots when they get onto the Cipressa and onwards. You're picking out riders and you're spotting who's where and working out, is that person too far back here? Because as we know from the way the race pans out, it's won on the Via Roma, as it will be this year, but it's lost at every metre in the last certainly 50-60 kilometres, where, you know, riders need to be in the position that they need to be in on certain climbs. I think that was illustrated most for me when I sat down with Mark Cavendish a while ago after he won Milan-San Remo and talked about what their strategy was, and he knew which sort of little knot of riders he needed to be in as he went over each of those climbs, and if he was in the right place, he was still confident that he'd be able to get up to the finish for the sprint. So not everybody needs to be in the same place. The sort of cliche is you need to be at the front to stay out of trouble, but Milan-San Remo is about using your engine the best way you possibly can, and for somebody like Cavendish and others, you know, they can afford to drift back down a little bit to conserve the legs as long as they're not slipping too far off the front.
That was an admirable piece of prevarication from both of you, but what is going to happen? I told you to get off the fence.
I'll mention a couple outsiders. I think Edvald Boasenhagen, I think, is a rider that if he's going to win any big one day classic, he's won again Wevelgem in the past, but if he's going to win one of the monuments, perhaps Milan-San Remo is his best chance. And I'll also mention Sylvain Chavanel, who I think rode reasonably at he'll have a free hand.
When's this podcast going out? In March 2007?
I'm picking outsiders here. I'm not going for the obvious ones. I'm picking outsiders. I think Chavanel, you know, I can see somebody like that going away and nobody reacting to it, because he is a rider who's, in the autumn of his career. He's an attacking rider, and he's always been there or thereabouts on the Poggio.
I think John Degenkolb had a suspiciously quiet week at Paris-Nice. You know, Christoph's been a lot more visible this spring. Degenkolb's been pretty quiet. I think he might be just keeping a low profile for Sunday.
Okay, so here's what's going to happen. Cancellara, if Nibali rides, because there's some uncertainty about whether he's going to ride or not, Nibali will attack on the Cipressa. It's one of the great cliches of professional cycling. Davide Rebellin, who I spoke to on Saturday,
he's not going to win it, is he?
A popular winner.
I'm just going in 2002.
He
the
would
podcast.
Be a popular winner.
1999.
He will also attack on the Cipressa. They will get caught. Six or seven riders get together between the Cipressa and the Poggio. Someone will stop working. There'll be words said. There'll be arms in the air. There'll be a lot of remonstration. That will break down. Cancellara, Van Mark, Van Avermaet. Probably those three. Gilbert, who knows, he might even attack behind Van Avermaet because they don't particularly get on or ride very harmoniously. Sagan might also be in that group. They won't win.
They're not Van Avermaet.
They'll all come together, and I think it will come down to a shootout between Christoph and Cavendish. In Cavendish's advantage, no Limagne. That has been a big thorn in his side, not in terms of dropping him, but in terms of taking some of the zip out of his legs ready for the sprint finish. So it's a big advantage for him that that's not in the route. But if it's a hard race, if it's been a hard race, then Christoph has a clear advantage, because we've said it many times before, he's the king of the sprint finish at the end of the hard long race.
Rebellin's still riding, and I had occasion recently to watch the 1992 Olympic road race in Barcelona, and he was riding there.
He turned pro about 3 weeks after that.
Yeah, amazing. What a guy. Ben Swift, we haven't mentioned. He was up there last year. He was third last year. Went very close. And on the training camp in Mallorca recently, at Team Sky, he said that Milan-San Remo was the race that he was keeping him going over the winter, that he was thinking about every day. You know, he recognises that this is his big opportunity. I don't think he's been in scintillating form this season. He rode Paris-Nice, did a job for the team there. But he's certainly somebody who, you know, will have the backing of his team, I think, at Milan-San Remo. Lionel?
Well, I've already said, I think John Degenkolb's going to win. So is that what are we being put on the spot here? Well, I'm off down the bookies in a minute.
Who did you say was going to win, Daniel?
Do we have to do the whole thing again?
Yeah, no, but you didn't say who was going to win, did you?
It was Christoph Cavendish.
Oh yeah, sorry, you did. Yeah, so apologies. I think Sagan will win then. Okay, after the attacks by Chavanel and Edvard Boasenhagen, Chavanel will attack on the way up the Poggio. Boasenhagen have a wee go over the top, and then it'll come back together. Sagan will win.
I'm not being critical here of friend of the podcast, Brian Smith's MTN Quebec team. But yesterday in Tirreno, it was like a football team with 12 strikers. They had Goss, Sialek, Boasenhagen, all leading out the same sprint. it was quite a sight to behold.
Well, that's a strategy, isn't it? As Brian Smith, who I don't think is a friend of the podcast officially. I mean, he is, but he's not a paid-up friend of the podcast. I've not noticed his fiver come in. Brian, if you're listening, we accept Scottish notes. But no, that, as he explained in a previous podcast, that's a strategy. We'll wrap it up there. We've got a lot coming your way in terms of friends specials. Remember, sign up thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you this week to our producer and editor, Alex Ade. Thank you, Alex. Thank you again to sponsors Van Dessel Cycles and British Eurosport. And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.